haven't done it in a while, and I thought it might be just appropriate to walk through a brief explanation, if you will, a Dabbadim words approach to who Yahweh is, to what he's like, to what he wants, to what he's offering, to how we can capitalize on it. And because there's so much to learn, we have a tendency to focus on tiny aspects of it, but I'd like to present it as a whole story, as a whole cloth, because who God is and what he wants and what he's offering is, well, it's the inverse of what we have been indoctrinated to believe based upon the religions that prevail in our culture. So, to begin, Yahweh is God's one and only name. He does not have many names. He does not respond if you don't know his name. This religious notion that I use the name Jesus Christ, and he knows who I'm talking to, even though there was no person named Jesus. Christ is not a last name, and there was no Christ. He is not Greek. And those are corruptions of Greek names. There wasn't even a J invented until the 17th century, so prior to the 17th century, no one had a name that began with a J. And the ous is to fit within Greek grammar rules and has no basis on Hebrew. And the basis of Christ in Greek means to apply drugs. So there's no Jesus Christ. And this notion that he knows who I'm talking to, no, he doesn't. Now, he does know who you're talking to, and it's not him, is the problem. Yahweh is really clear. He says, I only have one name. My name is really important. If we're going to have a relationship, which is really all God wants, you have to know my name. Now, today we're fortunate to have John, who's the general manager of GCN, producing the show. Scott is out getting some oral surgery with an implant. And if I were to refer to you as Mortimer, if I had to say, hey, so what do you think about this notion that God only has one name, Mortimer? Chances are you're not going to respond. But if I say, hey, John, what do you think about the idea of God saying that he only has one name and that he would like to be referred to by his name? Does that make any sense to you?
I suppose so.
Yeah. And when I asked you the same question as Mortimer, I didn't hear a peep because you know I'm not talking to you if I'm calling you Mortimer.
Correct.
Yeah. Well, so why would we come up with different names for God if he's told us his name? Wouldn't you think maybe just kind of the baseline requirement would be that if you want to talk with him, if you want to know him, that you might want to get to know his name?
Right. If you want to identify with him, you kind of have to know exactly.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. If I wanted you to respond, I wasn't going to ever get, I wasn't ever going to be successful calling you Mortimer, was I?
No, not at all.
No. Even if I say, hey, Mortimer, you the guy with the controls over this show, you'd find it insulting.
Right. Right.
Yeah. I mean, what's wrong with you? When we met, before you even were a host on this show, we've been communicating now for years. You know my name. Why would you call me Mortimer? Well, yeah, it was the same way. He says, let me introduce myself to you. I'm going to tell you my name, and I'm going to tell you that my name is really important to me because my name says so much about us. It not only says a lot about me, but it says a lot about us. It even says a lot about you. So what most folks probably don't know is that the Yahweh's introduction to us, which is called the Torah, it was not originally written in the language that we read it in today. English didn't exist, did it, John? Back 3,000 plus years ago. You'd have a real tough time finding a document in English back then. So God didn't speak in English, did he? As a matter of fact, Latin didn't exist as a language when the Torah was revealed. Greek did not exist as a language when the Torah was revealed. Hebrew did, though. It was the first alphabet conceived by humankind. And that alphabet is, and that language is really interesting because it tells us so very much. So if you look at the original alphabet, the first alphabet ever conceived by humankind, there's 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet, of which 5 are vowels, which are open mouth sounds, and 17 are consonants, which are closed mouth signs. Yahweh's name is comprised of 4 vowels, 2 of which are repeated, so 3 different letters. So if we were to examine those letters, we might come to know a little bit about him, since this was his name, and might come to know a little bit about us as well. John, I asked you earlier to guess how many times in the Torah, which means instructions and guidance, and not law, that Yahweh asked us to pray. And your answer was 28, I believe.
Correct.
And I told you were only off by 28, which time, since you thought it might be a lot more than that, that you went to 56. And I said, no, that's not the right direction. It's 0. So I'm going to ask you, and there's another question. How many times, since Yahweh was saying my name is really important to me, and it's, if you want to communicate with me, you need to know my name. How many times in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms do you think that Yahweh states his name? Now, I'm going to give you a couple of clues here. Yahweh's favorite number is 7. And its favorite number is 7 because man, which was created on the 6th day, plus God, who is 1, equals 7. So everything that Yahweh does is man with God equals 7. So perfection from God's point of view, the most important thing from his point of view is 7. So there's a clue. And now in the whole of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, how many times does Yahweh reveal his name, use his name?
I'm going to take a guess and say 7.
Nope. But 7's part of the number. 7,000.
7,000. Well, okay. Way off.
Well, can you imagine that? 7,000 times Yahweh uses his name in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. Now, if you were to open what's called an English translation of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, which is what Christians would call the Old Testament, how many times would you read Yahweh's name, do you think? The answer you'd think would be 7,000, right? Because there's exactly 7,000 uses of Yahweh's name in the original Hebrew. So you'd expect there to be 7,000, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Why don't you give me a different guess as to how many times you would read in any English translation, King James, New American Standard, the New Living Translation, all of these. In fact, you can pick any one of them. How many times?
I'm going to say 0.
That is correct. 0. So Yahweh used his name, wrote his name 7,000 times in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, and these books that are published as translations removed his name all 7,000 times. Now, what they removed his name and replaced it by, so there is a fairly consistent replacement of his name. What do you think they replaced it by? So where his name actually is, if you're reading what Christians would call the Old Testament, what do you think you'll find in place of his name?
Just Jesus?
No.
No?
No, because the name Jesus was first conceived in the 17th century.
Gotcha.
By the people that brought us the third edition of the King James, who's the first to use Jesus. And there is a person who bears the same name as Yahusha. Yahusha is the diminished manifestation of Yahweh. The person that Christians call Jesus is actually Yahusha. And in the Psalms, there is a Yahusha, who's a prototype, if you will, for the actual Yahusha. But no, they don't replace it with Yahusha, therefore not with Jesus. Lord. So it says the Lord. Every time that you Yod, Hey, Wah, Hey, which are the 4 letters that comprise Yahweh's name. Every place that's written, every English Bible translation replaces Yahweh with the Lord. Why would they do that? Okay, better question. Do you think that Yahweh, before I ask this question, I want you to think about what we've already talked about, that God does not want us bowing down to him. He gets on his knees to lift us up. God does not want us to fear him. He wants us to revere him and to respect him. He wants to get down on his knees to lift us up. He, rather than us babbling to him with our whole laundry list of things, he actually wants us to listen to what he has to say. He is never interested in us praising him and telling us him how wonderful he is. He is interested in us developing a relationship. So, and he is a liberator rather than an enslaver. So, when you consider the nature of a lord, you can go back to medieval times. There were lords and serfs, right?
Correct.
Were the lords the landowners?
I believe so.
Yeah, did the lords own the serfs, which worked on their property, as serf was essentially a slave?
Absolutely.
When a serf came into the presence of the lord, did the serf have to bow down?
Yep, absolutely.
Yep, and if the serf wanted to express their free will and do something other than the lord wanted, how long would that serf live?
I would guess not very long.
Not very long. Okay. So the Lord has to be obeyed, the Lord owns, and the Lord controls, and the Lord requires those beneath the Lord to bow down to them. So based upon what you've learned about Yahweh thus far, do you think that the term Lord applies to him? Is it something that he would choose?
I don't believe so, no. Not at all.
It's the opposite, right. And it's the opposite. He's a liberator. He wants to be dad. He wants to get down on his knees to lift us up. And he gave us free will. So he's the opposite of Lord. As a matter of fact, the Hebrew word for Lord is Baal. And you know the word that Yahweh uses most often to describe the adversary and false gods? Baal. Why? Because the adversary and false religious gods want that. Don't popes want you to bow down before them? Don't religions all have... I mean, the Catholic Church has bowing rails. Doesn't Islam require three times a day that you prostrate yourself five times a day? I mean, religions want you bowing down. So the God of religion, Yahweh calls the Lord the antithesis of himself. So we're getting to know a lot about not only God, but a lot about man by examining what he wrote versus what man has done to change what he wrote. For example, when he wrote Yahweh, that tells us a lot about him and us, and we'll get to that in a moment. And when man changed it 7,000 times to the Lord, creating a fearsome God that owns, controls, wants to be worshipped, possesses, tells us a lot about men, that A, you can't trust religious men because they made this change, so they're not trustworthy. But it also tells you about the kind of God that exists in their religion. This is a God that wants to lord over people. And according to Yahweh, the name Baal, the Lord, applies to false gods. It's the number one name that Yahweh applies to false gods throughout his Torah, prophets, and Psalms. It's interesting, by the way, that those same translations that replaced Yahweh's name with the Lord, when they see the Hebrew word for the Lord, Baal, oh, they'll just transliterate it and they'll write Baal. So most people don't even know that this corruption has been made. So we know that Yahweh doesn't like the term Lord. He views religious gods as lords. What about his name? Four letters in his name. They're all written by pictographs. The original Hebrew alphabet drew pictures so that even if you were illiterate, you could understand what's being conveyed. Every word in Hebrew is written with a series of figures that explain what the word means. Now, coming to know that Yahweh views himself as a father, and like father, wants us to have a relationship. He wants to empower his children, enrich his children, lift his children up in love, protect his children, give his children an inheritance, which is what the covenant is all about. Would you think, John, there'd be a reasonable chance that the Hebrew word for father would be prominent in the Hebrew language?
Absolutely.
What if I were to tell you that in every single Hebrew lexicon, the first word in alphabetical order is the Hebrew word for father?
I'd believe that.
Yep. So Yahweh wants to be our father. It's Ab in Hebrew. So there's four letters that comprise his name. If you're a dad, John, and you have a child, and you want to lift that child up, and you want to walk with that child, are you going to reach out your stretch out your leg to your child and tell your child, hey, you know, grab hold of my foot?
Of course, yeah.
Your foot? Is that what you're going to use?
Oh, not my foot, but yeah.
Are you going to reach out your hand?
A hand, yeah, there you go.
Okay. And are you going to clench your hand as a fist when you project it towards your child, or is it going to be an open hand?
Open hand.
All right. So, and if you're a little taller than a child, are you going to have your, is your arm going to be shown going down and then out with an open hand to your child?
Yes.
And would that be a sign that you want your child to grab hold of your hand because you want to lift them up and you want to support them as you walk together?
Of course, yeah. Extending an open hand, that's a sign of, you know, come with me, you know, helping you.
Okay. Now, based upon that, this first letter in Yahweh's name, it's a Yod. Which, by the way, the Hebrew word Yod that is, describes the letter is the Hebrew word for hand. How do you suppose that it was drawn based on what we just talked about?
His hand?
Yeah. How about an arm that an upper arm that comes down, a forearm that reaches out with an open hand?
That sounds right, yeah.
Yeah, well, that is the first letter in Yahweh's name. So that identifies him as a father reaching down and out to his children with an open hand. That's a pretty good start in terms of getting to know who he is. Now, there's two letters repeated in his name. The first of those of the repeats comes next. It's a hey in Hebrew. And there's two of them. The hey in Hebrew, the letter is defined by the Hebrew word meaning to look up, to reach up, to pay attention, to be observant. So, you know, just pay attention to what's around you. Particularly, I want you to look up and I want you to reach up. Now, you've learned that Yahweh doesn't want us to bow down and worship him. He's not insecure. So if you wanted to draw, if your name was written to convey that you wanted a relationship with people, would you perhaps, you think, have a person drawn in your name?
Sure.
How about two of them?
Why not?
Would they be on their knees or would they be standing?
They'd be standing.
Yep. Would they be reaching up for your hand, or would their hands be at their side saying, you know, your hands drawn at your side, I want to be all by myself. Hands reaching up as a child, you're reaching up, I want to engage, right?
Yeah, you'd be, yeah. Okay. Reaching out, yeah.
Okay. So what if I were to tell you the two Hays in Yahweh's name, the two people, are both standing up, they're both reaching up, they're both looking up to Yah. So we've learned that in Yahweh's name, we have a hand that's reaching down and out to us, and we have two people that are standing up, reaching up, looking up to him. We'll return. So Yahweh created a name which shows his role as someone who wants to greet us, welcome us, open hand, lift us up, and then two people standing up in his name, which means that you can't be bowed down if you're going to be in his name. You're going to be standing up. You're going to be reaching up, paying attention. The Hebrew word means to behold, to pay attention. And there's only one other letter. It's the Hebrew waw. The Hebrew waw means to join, to add, to increase. So there's two people who are being joined together at increase. Now, there's the dominant story in the Torah, the single most important story of the Torah, the story in the Torah that requires the most explanation, that is the most detailed, is the story of how Yahweh reached out to Abraham and Sarah to create the covenant, which was a family that gave birth to the first child of the covenant, whose name was Laughter, Yishak. And so you have in Yahweh's name two people. The first hay would be masculine. The second hay would be feminine. Represents the mother and father of the covenant, Abraham and Sarah. And the wall, that is the tent peg in Hebrew, was used to, because the tent was the only form of habitation of a home back in the day. It means to establish, to increase the size of, and to improve the security of a home, and to add to and increase the occupants inside of the home. And so that's Yahweh's name. And the home that is the covenant was comprised of the two individuals who are depicted in his name. So he tells us a lot about who he is and the fact that he has a name. He wants to be greeted by name in his very name. And then he goes through the process of creation. And the very first story, we have Yahweh greeting the man that he has created by getting down on his knees to lift him up. The Hebrew word is barak. Barak means to get down on one's knees and to lift up in love. And here is the Creator God of the universe showing himself doing the very thing that he wants to be part of this relationship forever. Not of us getting down on our knees to lift him up. That's pretty stupid, counterproductive. No, of him getting down on his knees to lift us up. Boy, isn't that the opposite of religion? Now, you not only have that, but then you have Yahweh explaining how he's spending his time with the human named Adam that he created. And, John, you know, we talked during the break. You said, you know, hey, I'm learning a lot here. It's fun to learn. And it is fun to learn. So, wouldn't you think if Yahweh had our best interest at heart, that he would figure out a way for us to grow by learning?
Absolutely.
So when he's depicted in the Garden of Eden, what do you think he's the one time that he is shown with Adam and they're spending time together, what do you think is happening between the two of them? Is Yahweh teaching Adam something? You know what he actually says he's doing? He parades life by. Yahweh thinks that life is his favorite part of creation. He just thinks that, you know, he created DNA and he created these living organisms. And he's really, I don't know if proud is the right term, but he's fascinated by life. And so he wanted to share life with his creation, with Adam. And so he parades the animals by and they get to talk about him. It's just very fitting for what a father wants to do with a child. We want to share with our children what we've come to know and learn, what we've done in our lives. We want to share it with them. And you know, you ever been to a place that your view was just beautiful? Maybe it's a beautiful sunrise, or it's a beautiful a rainbow, or a beautiful sunset, or just a beautiful vista. And if you're there all alone, you'll take it in, and okay. But if you're there with someone you love, you care about, isn't the whole experience more enjoyable?
Definitely.
Well, now you know why we exist. Yahweh thinks that the world that he created and the life in it is beautiful. It's interesting. It's fun to look at. But it's so much more enjoyable if you have someone to share it with. That's really all that exists of who Yahweh is and why he created the universe. See, God had everything that he could ever want except someone to share it with. We came to exist so that he would have someone to share with. And you know, dads grow by taking care of, by loving their children, and by teaching their children and helping their children grow is how we end up growing. And it's through those experiences. And so it's relationships that make life worthwhile. And so Yahweh created the universe and life in it just so that we could have a relationship together. And his foundational document, Torah, you know, the word Torah, doesn't mean law. It means to teach and to guide. Tells you a lot about who he is and what he wants. So here's God. He says, I created you to lift you up. I'm going to get down on my knees and like a loving father to lift you up. And I want you to inherit everything that I have. And I'm going to enrich you. I'm going to empower you. I'm going to perfect you. I'm going to do everything I can for your benefit. And the reason I'm going to do it is the more I do for you, the better it is for me. This is how simple it all is. And so the Hebrew word for covenant, you know, it sounds like a religious term. Boy, there's a covenant. You know, the Hebrew word for covenant, bereth, is based upon the Hebrew word bayeth, for family. And I mentioned father, mentioned home. The Hebrew word, the Hebrew letter, the second letter in the Hebrew alphabet is bayeth. It was drawn to depict a family home. And so the covenant is based on bayeth, the second letter in the Hebrew language, which depicts a home. And the covenant is nothing more than a family home. So, you know, here we have God saying, that's all I want. I want to introduce myself to you by name to let you know I am a loving father. I want to lift you up. I want you to participate in my home. I want you to be part of my home. And I'm going to give you everything that I have. I'm going to adopt you into my family. Well, that's what the covenant is. It's nothing more than Abraham becoming part of God's family. Now, what's interesting here is that religions would tell you that they're providing the way to God, and politics would tell you that they're providing for people's not only protection, but, you know, for their social security, for their health care, and that between politics and religions, and then militaries, of course, are providing for your freedom and all of this sort of thing. Well, God is saying that no, He wants to provide. He wants us to rely on Him, and that human institutions are really false hope. So what the only prerequisite for being part of the covenant is, I don't want you to drag those religious lies into my home. Think about this, John. If God told us that everybody could spend eternity in heaven, no matter how political they were, how militant they were, how patriotic they were, how political they may be, and all of those schemes have caused every war, most every famine, all of the suffering that we see, all of the enslavement. You know, we look at how America treated the Native American population. We talked about that during the break. Humans are really mean. And human institutions, like military institutions, political institutions, religious institutions, they're deadly. What would heaven be like if God said, I don't care what you believe or what you're affiliated with, if we drug that into heaven and now it's for all time, wouldn't heaven be just as miserable as conditions are here on earth?
It absolutely would be, yeah.
So wouldn't it be appropriate for God to say, you know, the last thing I want is people who are religious and political and militant in heaven so that heaven can be pleasurable for all of us? Let's not have the crud there.
Yes, absolutely.
Makes perfect sense, doesn't it? So God is saying the prerequisite is you want to be part of my eternal family, you want to inherit everything I have, you want to spend eternity growing and learning with me, don't drag that stuff in. That stuff's not welcome. Pretty simple. So all of these religions that claim that they are leading people to God are actually leading them away from God. He is not a religious deity. He is anti-religious. And so Christianity, rather than being a means to salvation, 100% of those who rely on the religion of Christianity are led away from God. Same thing is true with Islam and with Judaism. So the first thing that God asks if we want to engage in a relationship with Him is that we walk away from the corruption of human institutions. And the second is that we come to trust and rely on Him. If I showed you a bridge over a chasm, John, and I told you that you really should trust that bridge and rely on it. If you were completely unaware of who built it, how it was built, what kind of materials were used, and would you be able to trust that bridge was secure? Or would you need some evidence, you would need to know who the designer was, what materials they used, and some criterion for judging to trust, wouldn't you?
Yeah, absolutely. Like seeing someone else cross it, then yeah.
Yeah, maybe seeing somebody else cross it, or just seeing, you know, here's the designer, this is the designer's credentials.
Sure.
Here's the materials they used, and here's the quality of those materials, and here's the plan that was used to create the bridge. If you had all of that available to you, you could also ascertain whether or not that bridge was trustworthy, couldn't you?
Absolutely.
But if I didn't give you any of that, all you'd be left with is belief. Maybe a faith that the bridge might work, but nothing more than faith.
Sure.
So if Yahweh says, I want you to trust me, wouldn't you have to know who he is and what his plan was all about?
Absolutely.
Just like the bridge. And so if God didn't give you an introduction to who he was, it didn't supply his credentials and didn't present his plan, there would be no way to trust him, would there?
No, not at all.
And so that's what the Torah is about. The Torah introduces us to him by name, tells us what he is like, gives us his credentials, and then presents the plan that he used to and the materials that comprise the path from mortality to immortality. Exactly like the bridge. That's why, again, the Torah exists. So he says, trust and rely on me, which requires us to get to know him and understand what he is offering. When we return, we'll consider the next requirement to be part of his covenant family. It is one that takes a little bit of thinking to understand, but that's precisely the way God designed it. John, are you perfect?
Not at all.
Would you be, if I were to ask you, I want you to give up your job here with GCN, and I want you to devote all of your energy to being a perfect John. Would you be capable of?
I would try, but I don't think that's ever achievable.
No, and I'm not either. I'm particularly flawed and dented. In fact, I even think that some of our flaws is what gives us some character.
There you go, yeah.
You know, most interesting person, I think, in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms is a guy that is called David. There's no V in Hebrew. His name is actually Dod. And, you know, he was so flawed that one day he decided he wanted his general's wife because, you know what, he only had a handful of women in his harem, and she was prettier than some of the girls in his harem. So he wanted her, and he sent his general off to fight in a battle that he thought he would get him killed in so that he could add his wife to the harem. I would call that flawed. How about you?
Definitely.
Okay. Yeah. It's the wrinkles in our wardrobe. It's the dents in our armor that I think make us who we are, make us interesting as people. And so we're not capable of being perfect. And I think if we even were to, we'd become boring. But Yahweh says, "Walk to me and become perfect." Now, since we're incapable of it, do you think that in the book that he's conveying this to for his family, his covenant, is called guidance? Torah means guidance in Hebrew. Do you think maybe he provided the guidance as how we might be able to walk to him and become perfect?
I would think so.
All right. That's a good assumption. Now, you've come to know a lot about Yahweh and what he's like, so you would think that he wouldn't say, hey, you go figure it out. I'm going to tell you you need to walk to me and become perfect, but I'm not going to tell you how.
Right.
That's not in his nature. All right. Is there any place in the Torah that you can think of that is this huge journey, maybe an exodus, where you're leaving one place and walking to another? Is there a walk away from something that's really bad to something that's really good presented in the Torah?
Perhaps. Maybe.
Yeah. You ever heard of the Exodus?
Oh, sure.
Isn't the second book of the Torah, in English we call it Exodus, it's actually Shemot names, but isn't that one of the centerpieces of the Torah?
Absolutely.
And were the Jews in a good spot in Egypt, or was that a bad situation for them?
I think that was bad, and they were leaving it.
Yeah, so they were enslaved there, weren't they?
Yes.
Yeah. They had no control over their lives. And Egypt was one of the most religious places on earth. You know, the big pyramids are testaments to not only the religion, but the fact that the pharaohs presented themselves as gods. Extremely political place, one of the most powerful armies in the history of mankind. So it was a mix of politics and religion and militarism. And the economic scheme was to enslave others. The Jews were slaves. They were in a bad way. And Yahweh said, I want to take you away from this and walk you to the promised land. And that was the journey. Walk to me and become perfect. Walk away from, remember, you wonder the covenant, you have to walk away from religion and politics and militarism. Well, that's what existed in Egypt. They were slaves there. Walk with me to the promised land. I'm going to liberate you, free you. And I'm going to take you to a place where life will be wonderful together. And so that journey begins with an event called Passover. Remember the story of how Yahweh said, I want you to celebrate Passover with me in your homes, and your sons will live. Well, the sons that do not celebrate Passover, they will die.
Right.
Well, Passover is the doorway to life. And so the first step in the journey of walking to God and becoming perfect begins with Passover. Remember the next step? It's, I don't want you to put any yeast in your bread. I want you to have yeast, which is a fungus. I want you to eat the bread, but without yeast. That's the second day. It's called matzah. And matzah means I want the bread to be perfect. I don't want it to be corrupted with the fungus of yeast, because yeast is symbolic of all of our flaws, all of our dents, all of our imperfections. It's removed on matzah. That's the second step along the way. You go through the doorway of Passover, and the first step in this journey after Passover is through matzah, which is perfection. And the third step along the way, as demonstrated in the Exodus, in this walk to me and become perfect, is Bukkudim, where we're adopted into Yahweh's family, which leads seven Shabbat later, seven sevens later, to Shavuot, where that's when the Torah was given to Moshe and to the children of Israel, and that's when we're enriched and empowered by God. And there is the story of the covenant.